Election College, episode 254, Chester A. Arthur, part 2.
Let's throw a political party. Face it, the political scene sucks, but did it always? It's time for Election College, and class is in session. Now, your hosts, Jason Goff and Ben Smith.
Hey, Ben, where we left off in the last episode was in the election of 1880, and you had Conkling, you know, Roscoe, and his fellow stalwarts, which included Chester A. Arthur. They wanted to secure the nomination for their buddy, U.S. Grant. But the half-breeds, who were the other faction of the Republicans, wanted to have James G. Blaine selected as the candidate. Well, neither candidate gets the majority of delegates, and they vote 36 times. And guess what happens?
Well, I bet I know.
Yeah, you do. James Garfield. He emerges out of nowhere, out of Ohio, which is where every other Republican is coming from these days. And Garfield is like, hey, this is great. I'm going to be the Republican candidate. But our party is, a little bit split at this point. So what do? You select the opposing faction, a member of the opposing faction, to be your running mate. And that's exactly what the Republicans do. They say, hey, Chester, Arthur, you've got some nice sideburns. Come join Garfield.
Jason, I think it's interesting that he actually wasn't the first choice. There was a guy named Levi Morton who was the first choice, and he goes to Conkling, and Conkling says, no, don't do it. We'll lose. So they go to Arthur and they say, hey, Arthur, you want to do this? And Arthur goes to Conkling and he says, nah, don't do it. You'll lose. And Arthur says, nah, I'm going to do it. I don't really care what you say. So Arthur tells Conkling, he says, the office of the vice president is a greater honor than I ever dreamed of attaining. And so he runs. The election's really close. And, well, I mean, they win. So I guess it wasn't that close, right? They win. And it's really kind of an interesting race because, you know, the Civil War has happened 15 years ago or so. And the Union generals are both heading different tickets. So the Republican ticket and the Democrat ticket are being headed by Union generals. So they have to kind of really play dirty, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And of course, they start some, not rumors, but they start some tactics that are maybe unfounded at times. And long story short, Garfield and Arthur get elected 214 to 155 in the Electoral College.
Yeah, it's one of those situations, ladies and gentlemen, where if you don't like the Electoral College, well, you can see why. It's kind of a good idea because they won the popular vote by just 7,000 votes. But it's pretty unanimous when it comes to the Electoral College, if you take that perspective. After the election, Arthur does what every good vice president does. He tries to load up the cabinet with a bunch of New York stalwarts. And Garfield's like, no, thank you. And guess what, Arthur? You go over there because I don't think that I really want you around. Arthur ends up giving a speech before reporters saying that the election in Indiana had been won by Republicans through some illegal maneuvers. And Garfield's like, what? And Arthur does take a very, very far back seat in the administration.
So the factions are still at it, and there's some kerscuffle over Garfield's nominations for the cabinet seats and everything like that. And Conkling is opposed to some of them, of course, at times. And just before the Senate goes into recess in May of 81, Conkling and Thomas C. Platt, who is a senator from New York, they both resign because they don't like the fact that Garfield is fighting against them. And Chester Arthur at this time is like, wow, this is all pretty interesting. I'm going to go to New York City because he doesn't really have anything to do in Washington, especially when the Senate isn't in session. And he travels there with Conkling, and he hopes to get reelected to the Senate pretty quickly. And Conkling does, that is. And yeah, it becomes kind of a whole thing. Really quickly thereafter is when Garfield gets shot. And Arthur is in Albany when he finds that out. And, of course, we talked in the episode about the episodes about Garfield, about Gateau and all the crazy stuff that he did where he'd walk around the White House and everything. Well, again, eventually he is able to shoot Garfield. And there's some crazy... This is one of those times where people are just like, what do we do? Because the presidential succession kind of... ideas and the way that works aren't 100% clear, yeah. I guess you could say. They're not really sure who, if anybody, is even allowed to pick up the authority of the president. So after Conkling resigns, there's also no president pro temp in the Senate. And so you have Arthur, who's probably going to, you know, move up, and then you don't have anybody to replace him. And like I said, that's just kind of a messy time.
Yeah. Garfield is shot on July 2nd and doesn't pass on until September. Arthur is laying low in New York and doesn't really do much at all. And on September 19th, Garfield does pass, and Judge John R. Brady of the New York Supreme Court administers the oath of office in Arthur's home at 2:15 in the morning. Later that day, he hops on a train, pays his respects to Garfield, and heads on to New York City. And he participates in Garfield's funeral. And then he ensures the presidential line of succession by preparing and mailing to the White House a proclamation calling for a special session for the Senate. What this does is it says that the Senate will immediately convene and choose a Senate pro temp who will be able to assume the presidency if Arthur dies. Lots of dynamics going on here, and I can't imagine with how slow communication would have been during that time, because, yeah, you had means of, like, the telegraph, but you're still, it's, you know, it's not the internet. It's not the phone.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's not even, let alone the internet, it's not even the phone. So Arthur gets to Washington on September 21st. On September 22nd, he retakes the oath of office, and just to make sure that, you know, everything is fully in compliance, because the last thing you need is to find out that your president really isn't the president. So his sister, Mary Arthur McElroy, ends up serving as the hostess, because, again, Arthur's wife had passed away a few years before. And, you know, everybody's like, so, you know, the president's single. Does that mean it's kind of a free game? Anybody wants to try to marry the president, you can have at it. But again, he is very devoted to his late wife and isn't really interested in that at the time.
Yeah. And there's quite a bit of infighting going on with Garfield's cabinet because, of course, most of them represented the opposition within the Republicans. And he did ask the cabinet members to stick around until December when Congress reconvenes. But William Windom, who is the Treasury Secretary, is like, I'm getting out of here. And then Arthur selects Charles Folger, who was one of his buddies, a stalwart from New York, to be Windom's replacement. Several other members of the cabinet resign, and Arthur is left with making the decision of, do I select these stalwart buddies of mine or move on and try to be a compromise president? He does retain Robert Todd Lincoln, interestingly enough, as his Secretary of War. But Ben, this is what I love about Arthur's legacy. is the very things that he was fighting against all of his life, all of his political life, that is, in building up the machine politics of the day. He actually goes in and gets a lot of reforms done for civil service. The good old boy system was not defended well by the Arthur administration.
Yeah, so this is really important because before this, like Jason said, it's kind of a good old boy system and people can be promoted or moved up or around or whatever by preference or by seniority, perhaps even sometimes. But in Arthur's first presidential address to Congress, he asks or requests for civil service reform legislation. And it doesn't get passed right away, and it doesn't get passed for a while either. But when everybody becomes lame ducks and it comes up again, the Senate approves the bill, and then the House does as well. So Arthur signs that into effect, and it kind of changes a lot of things that we still feel the repercussions of today. At first, the act was really only applicable to a small amount of jobs in the federal government. It ended up going further than that later on.
Yeah, and then you had this whole issue of surplus because, well, there was a lot of revenue that was held over from the Civil War with the taxes. And the federal government had collected more than it spent to the point by 1882, the surplus reached $145 million. Get that. And yeah,
I'd take that. That's fine.
And there are all kinds of opinions, depending on if you're a Republican or Democrat, of what you should do. And the Republicans said that high tariffs ensured high wages. And they were like, hey, let's spend more on internal improvements and reduce excise taxes. And Arthur is like, that sounds like a good idea. So in 1882, he calls for the abolition of excise taxes on everything except liquor. On the civil rights front, Arthur really struggled with how the Republican Party was going to challenge the Democrats and how they were going to protect the civil rights of African Americans in the South. You see, since the end of Reconstruction, these conservative white Democrats, they were back in power, and the Republican Party dwindles in the South. And this resulted in the disenfranchisement of many African Americans in the South. And Arthur ends up compromising in some ways with Southern Democrats and even some Southern Republicans. And this does not bode very well on the national front.
There's also the Civil Rights Act of 1875 that the Supreme Court actually strikes down in 1883. And Arthur is like, nope, don't like that. Wasn't a fan of that. Hey, Congress, we really need to do something. But they don't want to, which dismays him, of course. And he does end up overruling a court-martial against a black individual who was a cadet at West Point. And there are, of course, many different situations where things are just the way they are because of someone's color. And so those injustices, Arthur was a big advocate against those types of things. The other thing that they kind of dealt with during that time was that the Latter-day Saints was under some government pressure to stop being polygamist out in the area where the Utah Territory was. And Garfield is like, yeah, polygamy is bad and it's criminal and it's morally wrong. And Arthur's like, yep, I agree with what he said, and I'm going to sign Edmunds Act into law, which makes polygamy a federal crime. And it actually doesn't just make it a crime. It makes it so that polygamists are not able to be in public office, nor have the right to vote. So pretty strong stance there.
And there's some interesting dynamics going on with the Native Americans because the Indian Wars are winding down and people are thinking, hey, we need to treat Native Americans well. And Chester Arthur said, hey, Congress, we need to increase funding for the education of Native Americans. But Congress wasn't so keen on that. They didn't approve it as much as he would have liked. Arthur was very supportive of individual Native Americans owning land, and others were much more supportive of the tribe owning the land. And this doesn't do very well for the future of the Native Americans, this whole thing of individual ownership, because what ends up happening is white speculators end up purchasing the land from the individual Native Americans, and that really encroaches on their territory.
Shortly after becoming president, Chester Arthur gets diagnosed with a kidney condition called Bright's disease, and they refer to it now as nephritis. And he really tries to keep that condition private, but it wasn't long before people started to find out. He gets thinner, and he really is struggling to keep up with the pace of the job. He and some friends, who are political friends, say, we got to get out of Washington. They go down to Florida in April of 1883. And, you know, usually at this time when people would go south and try to be in the warmer weather, it's supposed to help them recover. But it actually has the opposite effect on Chester Arthur. He has some really intense pain and some other ailments as well, and ends up going back to Washington. And later that year, he heads over to the Yellowstone National Park. And this is kind of a nice sightseeing visit. And they're really trying to publicize the national park system that had been established. Well, this trip actually helps Arthur's help a little more than going to Florida did. And he ends up being gone for about 2 months before he comes back to Washington, a little more rested up.
So the 1884 election is approaching. And people are like, Arthur, I don't think you're going to make it. Let's just be blunt here. It doesn't look well for you. So James Blaine is considered the favorite for the Republican nomination. James Blaine does get the National Convention's nomination for the Republicans. And, well, it doesn't end up well for the Republicans. Arthur leaves office in 1885, goes back to his New York City home. And some of his stalwart buddies are like, hey, buddy, do you want to run for the Senate? And he says, nope, I'm going to go back to practicing law. And his health limits his activity with the firm that he joins, and he only serves in the role of a counsel. So he makes a couple of appearances until the end of 1885, but then shortly thereafter, in 1886, he passes away. Get this, Ben. He was only 57 years old.
Yeah, that's crazy. When he was getting pretty seriously ill there before he passed away, he ordered that all of his papers, whether they were personal or official or anything else, be burned, which is kind of crazy. Makes you wonder why. Anyway, he had a funeral at the Church of the Heavenly Rest in New York City. And, of course, you know, President Hayes and President Cleveland and other important individuals came. And he gets buried at the Albany Rural Cemetery in Menards, New York. Of course, he was buried beside his wife.
Yeah, so Arthur's legacy is very much, well, a lot of people just don't know about his administration because, let's face it, a lot of the presidents from this era are forgotten about. But I like to think of Arthur as somebody who he basically was the machine guy, but then when he is in office as the president, he chills out on that and does a lot for reform, opposing those things that he claimed to have stood for prior to taking office.
Yeah, it's always a little crazy how you think one thing and later in your life, you might think another, and sometimes circumstances or more knowledge can change those things. So it's always interesting to see how people change and adapt to their surroundings and maybe fight against something they used to be for.
He could have grown a fuller beard, though. I give Garfield a much better beard rating than Arthur.
That's very true.
So, but speaking of ratings, we love it when we get new ratings and reviews in iTunes. And you can participate by heading over to electioncollege.com/review or electioncollege.com/iTunes. and you can leave us a rating and review. It helps us get the podcast in front of more people just like you.
That's right. And people just like you, we like to talk to you. Head over to Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. If you see something, say something. And you know what I mean. Just talk to us.
Yeah.
Say hello. We like that.
All right. We'll see you guys next time.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.